I'm Dr. Robert Zeev, Medical Director of Partners in Integrative Cancer Therapies in Prescott, Arizona, and this is Healthy Medicine, your show about intelligent, scientific, common sense medicine and strategies for effective, affordable health care. Hi, everyone. We're glad you're joining us today. As many of you who listen to our show are probably aware, I often will interview leaders in their fields from across the nation. But we do make an effort to include local and state guests who are offering therapies, classes, or community programs that help everyone in the area. This is what we're going to be doing today. We hear the word mindfulness everywhere these days, but like so many words, it can either just become another buzzword. We assume we know what it means because we've read about it. Oh yeah, I know what that means. Or we assume that we know what it is without ever practicing it. Or in our minds, with our great intellects and so forth, we know how to categorize or file this term away and put it in the category of mind, body, spirit. And so what is mindfulness? How mindful are we on a daily basis? And why even practice or learn mindfulness? These are some of the questions we're going to ask today's guest. Her name is Paula Sarvani, with whom I've had the privilege to work with at our clinic, Partners in Healthcare Naturally, here in Prescott. Paula is a certified mindfulness meditation teacher, as well as being the front office manager at our clinic. And I can tell you, in working with her in the clinic weekly, daily, often, that she practices mindfulness all the time, and I think this is why our clinic runs so smoothly. She has worked in the field of health and wellness for more than 30 years and is a longtime practitioner of meditation and other spiritual disciplines. Thanks for joining us today, Paula.
Thanks for having me.
We're really glad you're here.
Me too.
I think this is such an important subject. So what is mindfulness?
Well, I think the basic working definition of mindfulness would be non-judgmental awareness in the present moment. So that sounds pretty simple, but as you know, and as anyone knows who has tried to practice that, it's probably one of the most difficult things for us to do.
The image that came up in my mind was remembering many of the times when I've been driving on the road and someone pulls out in front of me or does something stupid when they're driving that's not considerate of the other person. And I often don't remain mindful. I get reactive. I can have the tendency to get reactive. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, sure. I mean, And I think we all do. And yeah. I think that your very generous comment about me being mindful quite often in the clinic is much appreciated. And I don't think it's possible for us to be mindful in every moment. I mean, I think it's possible, but I think the reality of it, as I said, is much more challenging and difficult than one would think. And we find that out when we begin to try to practice it.
Does your practice of mindfulness, I guess what I was getting at is, I'm not saying at the clinic and when we work together that you're mindful every moment. I notice that your capacity to stay focused in the moment is remarkable often. And I think that's what helps this clinic a lot. So does practicing mindfulness on a daily basis help you stay in the moment in your work?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the benefits that have been shown about mindfulness practice in many of the studies that have been done, that it does increase concentration, increase the ability to stay focused. And also, the more that we practice that, the more we then are able to expand our awareness into maybe what we could call field attention. So in fact, even though mindfulness specifically is about paying attention to this present moment, it also allows us over time to be able to hold a lot of different things in the field of our awareness. So for example, in the job at the clinic, you know, we're keeping a lot of things in mind at one time. which doctor is with which patient in which room and who's coming next and who needs to be taken care of and who am I speaking to on the phone, and the ability to collect ourselves and focus our vital energy allows us then to expand outward also.
Does the mindfulness help you when I come up to you when you're on the phone with somebody making a call to a patient and you have to stay focused in that moment and Dr. Z will take care of himself. I'll talk to him later.
Yeah. It's the ability to be present in whatever we're doing at the moment, but again, also be aware of what's happening in the environment around us, what also might need attention in the next moment. So it's really a way of staying fluid and being able to, you know, meet each moment in our lives, which is, you know, this idea of meeting the moment, which is what I call all of my programs and my consulting practice, comes from that wonderful quote from Martin Buber, which is all real living is meeting. And I just, I loved that. And I adopted that because it just, to me, really describes what life is all about. Life is all about each moment we're meeting something or someone or some thought or some emotion. Each moment is an encounter, and we can either be present for that moment, or we can try to push that moment away, or we can try to grasp onto it. And the point of mindfulness, one of the points of mindfulness, is to be able to just be with whatever is happening in the present moment of our experience without having to react to it. So we're really talking about being rather than doing, which in our culture today is really kind of a foreign concept.
So does that meeting the moment include the times when thoughts come up in each of us that tell us I'm worthless, there's not enough, and I'm not going to make it kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not reacting to those thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the same time, not reacting to them, but at the same time, just allowing them to be there, to just let them be. Because what happens is habitually, when a thought or an emotion or a person or a circumstance arrives that we don't like for some reason or that we find challenging, our first response is to try to push it away,
right,
to make it go away. Right. You know, if it's a thought or a feeling, we try to suppress it.
Right.
But what happens when we do that is the same thing that happens if we have, you know, let's say we have a cut on our hand and we try to kind of cover it over.
Mm-hmm.
Before it's healed. So what happens is it starts to fester, it starts to become infected, and if it continues to stay suppressed without the flow of energy allowed to complete itself, then we have sepsis, then we have a systemic infection.
Right.
So we're really just creating more suffering for ourselves. But it takes a lot of intention and a lot of practice to actually be able to do that. And this is there's no top end to this practice, as, you know, Werner Erhard would say. You know, there's no reaching the end point of mastery. It's an ongoing, living, breathing process that we each undergo every single day and every moment. And no one does it perfectly, I don't think.
Yes. Reminds me of that quote that we really recently worked on, success is not final. So when you practice this, you're not reaching the place where I've succeeded at being mindful and I don't have to keep practicing it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And it's that attitude of striving. You know, we're not practicing mindfulness or meditation for a specific outcome, even though both of those things have been shown to have some specific outcomes, like people feel more relaxed, they feel more at ease, improved cognitive function, you know, many health benefits. But as soon as we start to practice in order to achieve something, we've missed the point. So the point is to cultivate this mood of non-striving, again, resting in just being with, without having to get anywhere, without having to improve ourselves. We're just being with who we really are, which is this open space of awareness that is part of each of us. It's not something we have to go out, you know, hunt it down and then, you know, and then find it. It's not something that we're missing. It's part of who we already are. It's already present. So what we're doing when we're practicing is just allowing it to be. And sometimes what we see is that there we have a lot of overlays that are covering that up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our conditioning, certain belief systems that we have, difficult emotions that we're carrying with us, but it's already there. So really, there's this tremendous sense of relaxation and relief to just realize that we actually have everything that we need. We're whole and complete the way, you know, exactly the way we are, even with the things that are challenging to us.
So you don't have to do anything in order to be mindful. Is that what you're saying? Am I misinterpreting it?
No, we could say that you don't have to do anything. At the same time, there are things that one can do
mm-hmm.
that will create favorable circumstances for mindfulness, let's say. So when we are sitting in meditation, so meditation is really the foundational practice of mindfulness,
mm-hmm.
but there are ways, of course, to be mindful in all the moments of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So when we sit in meditation, it's very important, for example, to maintain an erect posture. So an erect, not a rigid posture, but an erect posture. Because as soon as we find our seat,
mm-hmm.
as they say, as soon as we sit upright, we automatically tap into the part of ourselves that is intrinsically dignified and noble, just by sitting up straight. And of course, when we sit up straight, our vital energy flows more freely. And that brings a certain kind of awake quality to our mind. So there are small things that we can do that will facilitate this access to this open state of awareness. But the doing, again, is not the point.
Got it. So how does the breath, I know you focus on the breath in the classes, because I've been to some of your classes. They're ongoing classes, I just want to mention. Let's circle back around to talking about the breath, that this fall, you're planning on expanding what you're offering locally, correct?
Yeah, I don't have a timeline quite yet, but a new beginning session, Introduction mm-hmm. to Mindfulness and Meditations, is already full, I'm happy to say.
Mm.
And then as we go along here, I'm looking at doing like a second level
mm-hmm.
meditation class, and then maybe like some half-day workshops that take some of the principles that we talk about in class and go into them more deeply.
So there's no quiz in these classes.
No, right? No. Yeah. No. Well, there is homework. You know, the homework is to actually
practice. Yeah.
But no, there's no testing, no quizzes. It's really important to me. And one of my main intentions in offering these programs is to really create a space of sanctuary for people. So a place where they can come to get off the hamster wheel of the busyness and the stress that we all experience in our lives, and just come together again to just be, to just rest in who we actually are, in an environment that is hopefully has some humor, that it has some inspiration to it, and that really cultivates this mood of acceptance and loving kindness. So I think we tend to be really hard on ourselves, and part of my intention is to really bring a mood of acceptance so that we can just all be exactly as we are, warts and all. You know, it's not about doing anything perfectly. It's about just being willing to just sit, really,
yes.
with the breath and the body as an anchor.
So let's go into that a little bit. How does the breath, what role does the breath play in mindfulness?
Well, the breath, I mean, that's a topic that is very rich and very multifaceted and multi-layered. But on a very basic level, the breath is something that we always have, as long as we're alive, mm-hmm. we're breathing. Mm-hmm. So it's an anchor that we can use to bring ourselves back to the present moment. So whenever we feel our thoughts wandering, whenever we find we're in an emotional state that we feel overwhelmed by, the breath is always there. We can always come back to it as a reliable anchor. So that's one of the reasons that I focus on the breath and the body, because it can provide a sense of stability when we're feeling unstable.
You know, I just want to make a comment there. I just noticed during our interview here that my cell phone vibrated, and in the past, you know, I would have wanted to answer it and see who it is and what the message is. And I, you know, more and more in practicing mindfulness on a daily basis, I'm able to just let it be there, and it'll be there when I'm ready to answer it. I don't have to do it now, you know.
Yeah.
Don't have to be there to respond to that. So.
Yeah, that's one of the things about, you know, our increasingly technological culture is our attention is being...
Distractions.
Distractions kind of being pulled from us all the time, especially with cell phones, you know. This idea of we have to be available, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that's very stressful. So our life force is constantly going out. It's going outward. Our attention is constantly being enticed from us or pulled from us. And one of the things about meditation and mindfulness is we have an opportunity literally to collect ourselves, mm-hmm. to bring our vital force and our vital energy and our attention back to ourselves. So I really like this phrase. You know, we use this phrase all the time. We pay attention. Mm-hmm. And that's literally true. Mm-hmm. So we pay with our attention. Whatever we put our attention on is where our life force goes. So every time we put our attention on something, our vitality and our life force goes toward that thing. Mm-hmm. So if we're constantly being bombarded with text messages and cell phones and instant messaging and all of the things that are out there, all of our life force is just is dissipating. So we have an opportunity to like collect our attention, collect our life force kind of back into our bank account of vitality.
You know, that's well put, bank account.
You know, that it's like that. So we keep spending, right. spending, and we wonder why we're exhausted and stressed and depressed and feeling hopeless about our lives. Like all of our juice is just like flowing indiscriminately from us a lot of the time. So that's the other thing that we're learning through meditation and mindfulness is we're learning how to pay attention, and we're learning to notice where our attention is going. And once we see it, then we have more agency over it. Then we can make some choices about it once we're aware of it. But if we're unconscious about it, it's just going wherever it's being,
right.
called to at the moment.
Right. Okay, I think this is a good place to take a break, and let's come back in part two of Healthy Medicine and talk more about mindfulness with Paula Sarvani. Hi, this is Dr. Zeev, and we're back on part two of Healthy Medicine. We're talking about mindfulness today with Paula Sarvani, with whom I work at Partners in Healthcare Naturally here in Prescott. Paula is a certified mindfulness meditation teacher, as well as being our front office manager. And let's go further into some of the issues here, Paula, that we started to raise. I remember in the classes that I've taken with you that have really helped me that you stress you don't have to do anything. How important is that to the process of mindfulness?
I think it's very important, and it's actually that attitude of non-striving is one of the fundamental attitudes that we're bringing to the practice. It's almost part of the definition of mindfulness. Again, we're cultivating the ability to just rest in being rather than this idea of doing, and this idea that somehow there's something missing in ourselves that we need to acquire in order to be happy or fulfilled.
What do you say to people who might say, I'm striving to do something, succeed in my life, or I'm striving to whatever that may be, and then you say that it's not about striving?
Well, one of the things we talk about in class is the difference between intention and goals. So I think we all have goals in life. Mm-hmm. We all have things that we want to accomplish. We all have things that we want to do, things that we want to have. So I would consider those to be goals. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of outcome-oriented. Mm-hmm. But intention is something different. So intention is more about who we are and the things that matter to us. So, for example, one of my intentions is to be authentic and open-hearted.
Mm-hmm. Which you do very well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And so what we want to bring to our mindfulness practice is, I think it really helps to think about this idea of what is our intention? Why are we coming to this practice? What is it that we want for ourselves at the deepest level, which may include maybe we want to develop more compassion for ourselves, mm-hmm, and for others. Maybe we want to deepen our relationship to ourselves in some way, mm-hmm, which is different than a goal, which is different than saying, you know, I want to make a certain amount of money by the end of the year. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with the goals. And they work together. Mm-hmm. Intention and goals work together. Mm-hmm. But I think what happens is we often get caught up in the goal-oriented mentality, and we kind of leave some deeper parts of ourselves behind in that process. And eventually that, I think, catches up to us in some form or another.
When we haven't done it perfectly and haven't gone far enough down that road of success relative to those goals, that's when that inner critic, as some psychotherapists call it, starts to assert itself in many of us. And my sense is, and my experience has been, by practicing mindfulness, we create that space in ourselves so that both that inner critic as well as our own peace of mind can be present at the same time. Is that an accurate statement of what we can gain through mindfulness?
Yeah, practice? Exactly. That's one of the many things that we can gain. We get to actually see the different parts of ourselves, the different, you know, eyes, if you will, the different voices. You know, when we're sitting, mm-hmm, in silence with ourselves, we really start to see our thoughts and our emotions pretty clearly, which can be challenging, which is one of the reasons why it's so hard to do. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it can be incredibly freeing to just be able to notice that critical voice and just notice and kind of go, wow, that's interesting that part is there. And then again, once we notice that it's there, we can make some decisions about how we relate to that. So we're not changing the content as much as we are changing our relationship, mm-hmm, to it.
Yeah, I see that. So let's talk about meditation, because I know it's called mindful meditation. And a lot of people associate meditation with Eastern disciplines and stuff. But I remember reading that in the Christian tradition, meditation is very strong. And there's meditations that St. Augustine taught, and I could be wrong on that, but that's what I remember. And what is meditation and its origins, and how do you respond to those kind of questions? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of, I'm a generalist, you know, so, mm-hmm, I study a little bit about a lot of things, mm-hmm, and I've studied some about different world religions, mm-hmm, over my lifetime, and I think that there is some form of meditation, some form of contemplative practice in all of the world's religions. So it's not, it doesn't exclusively, right, belong to the East, mm-hmm, although my personal practice and my experience is more based in the Eastern traditions. Mm-hmm. So the kind of meditation that I teach in class is a very, it's like the most basic form of meditation there is. Basic seated meditation in a chair, focusing on the breath and using the body as an anchor. I do it that way very intentionally. It's like the most foundational building block of meditation that there is, because that way it's accessible to everyone. So you don't have to have a certain belief system. You don't have to follow a particular religious or spiritual path. Anyone can practice meditation in a very simple form that doesn't involve a lot of trappings of various kinds. And that's one of the reasons that I'm so interested in presenting the material the way I do. I really want to make it accessible to everyone. Mm-hmm. So,
in other words, the image that comes up in my mind as we're talking is the image of the tree, and like mindfulness is the trunk, roots of the tree, and all the branches coming off are all the different religions and stuff, but all those religions have in their base a certain practice of mindfulness and contemplation. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm.
So is the idea then to set aside time every day to practice mindfulness?
Yeah.
How do you talk about that?
Yeah, that would definitely be my suggestion. So just to maybe make a little bit more of a clarification or distinction, we're talking about mindfulness and meditation.
Okay.
And those two things could be considered to be the same thing, mm-hmm. but also there is a little bit of a difference. So meditation is it's a formal practice. It's mm-hmm. something that we set aside time to do, hopefully every day. Mm-hmm. We assume a certain upright posture, and we sit there for a specified period of time, mm-hmm. bringing our attention back to the breath whenever we notice that our attention has wandered. So it's a very specific practice. Mindfulness could also be seen as a practice. Mm-hmm. But it's also, to me, mindfulness is more of a state. Hmm. So it's more of a state of being. Mm-hmm. We're being mindful. Again, we're resting in that open state of non-judgmental awareness. That, to me, is mindfulness. So mindfulness is more of a state, and meditation is a specific practice. But, of course, they are intertwined.
Mm-hmm. So when you're practicing mindfulness, and other thoughts of mindful meditation, and is the idea is that when thoughts come into your mind, like I have to go there, I have an appointment then, or I have to call this person, and you're being reminded of all these things, is it the capacity to say those will be there when I get up in 5 minutes after I practice a little mindful meditation?
Yeah, like the practice of meditation, again, allows us to collect ourselves and gives us the ability to notice our thoughts and emotions as they arise and subside without having to latch onto them or to be kind of taken away by them. So one of the things that we notice after we practice for a while, one of the benefits that we get to see is that everything is impermanent. So nothing lasts forever. So we see this thought, it comes, and then if we leave it alone mm-hmm. and just let it be, it just comes and it goes, just like the breath. So that's another one of the benefits of focusing our attention on the breath, because we get an immediate, visceral knowing of a very important aspect of reality, which is that everything is impermanent. So the breath comes in and it dissolves mm-hmm. and it comes in and it dissolves. It arises and
Good
it subsides,
point.
Which is true for everything.
Yes.
So then we get to see that, oh, this strong feeling that I'm having that is challenging to me right now, we begin to know that this too shall pass, not as a way of pacifying ourselves, but as a way of just being with the truth of how things are. So that really over time gives us more and more of a capacity to have emotional resilience, for example. So we don't have to be kind of taken under by strong feelings that are difficult for us, because we know from our own experience of following the arising and subsiding of the breath, of noticing our thoughts come and go, we know it's not a theory. We know for ourselves that this state, this thought, this feeling, this circumstance, this body, this person is impermanent and will not last forever. Which, of course, you know, once you start really considering that more deeply, you know, that mm-hmm. there are lots of different levels that can go to as well.
So mine, a lot of people, I think, perceive that practicing mindfulness is something passive, but I'm feeling from what you're saying that it is a very active participation in the moment.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not passive. So yeah. I think that's one of the misunderstandings. So often when we're talking about mindfulness, we're talking about accepting what is. We're talking mm-hmm. about accepting.
Accepting is not being passive to what is.
Right, exactly. So accepting.
I think that's what I was trying to
yes,
say.
Yes, so this idea of acceptance, which is also one of the foundational attitudes that we want to bring to our practice, it doesn't mean that we agree with what's happening, that we support what's happening, that we condone what's happening, that we want it to continue. It just means that we allow it to be because, in fact, it already is. Mm-hmm. It's already here. Mm-hmm. So accepting is just acknowledging that it's already here. And, you know, what is the phrase? Pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. So, you know, all of us will experience pain in our lives of various kinds, physical, emotional, but the suffering comes in when we start to deny what is actually happening.
I get it. I hear you.
Yeah.
So what's the distinction between meditation and prayer?
Wow, that's a great question. I think that prayer, I think that also depends on which spiritual tradition you're speaking to or coming mm-hmm. from. But I think prayer has more of a mood and an intention of maybe of supplication. I think there are lots of different kinds of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of about... usually we're praying to something. We're praying to some mm-hmm. Deity or to some mm-hmm. Higher power or mm-hmm. however we would want to say that. We are actively creating a relationship with that force, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
I think meditation is different, again, in that we aren't kind of going anywhere with it or doing anything with it. It's more that we're just allowing what is to be there.
Being present with it non-judgmentally.
Yes.
Right.
And that non-judgmentally piece is you know, it's you can see, you know, it rolls off the tongue very easily,
right.
But
it does.
That's
yeah.
really... That's really
our brains can categorize those statements, and we think that, you know, we got that one down, kind of thing. Or, so have you worked individually with people? I'm just curious. And what kind of feedback do you get from people who come to the classes or people you worked with individually in mindful meditation?
Yeah, I haven't worked with so many people individually in this context
uh-huh.
when I was living in community and, which I did for a very long time,
mm-hmm.
I would often be asked to help people or support people, be part of support groups or individual one-on-one interactions with people. The feedback that I'm getting from the classes is very good and very makes me very happy.
Hmm.
And, you know, people seem to really be... experiencing something for themselves through it that they're finding to be valuable, which is my intention, which is my hope.
So how often per day do you advise people to set aside a time to practice mindful meditation?
So one of the things we talk about in class is that if you've never meditated before, it's a really good idea to just start with small increments.
Mm-hmm. Like a couple minutes, you mean?
Or yeah, well,
5 minutes?
I would say, 5 minutes would mm-hmm. be the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to set a goal for yourself that's actually doable mm-hmm. so that, I think that also tends to be a common human tendency. We kind of set our sights really high.
Right.
We set the bar really high, then we can't meet it, then we beat ourselves up. Then, we're in the downward spiral of self-judgment. So we want to set a goal that's reasonable,
mm-hmm.
that we really think you can do. So in the class, we start with 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very rewarding for people who've wanted to meditate and have struggled with it to realize that, okay, they've just done it. That mm-hmm. was it. I did it.
Mm-hmm.
I just meditated for 5 minutes. Yeah, just really small amounts of time. The idea, of course, is to increase the amount of time over time, which we also attempt to do in class. Mm-hmm. So we start with 5 minutes, and then we sit for 10, and then mm-hmm. 15 and 20.
Hmm.
And in our every other Wednesday night meditation group, which people are invited to attend after they complete the introductory
mm-hmm.
program,
mm-hmm.
we're now sitting for 20 to 25 minutes.
Hmm.
But, people meditate for up to hours at a time, but that's, you don't start there. And you don't necessarily have to get there either.
Okay, let's take a break and come back on part three of Healthy Medicine with this life-enhancing discussion on mindfulness with Paula. Hi, this is Dr. Zeev, and we're back in part three of Healthy Medicine. We're speaking today in dialogue with Paula Sarvani about mindfulness. Paula is a certified mindfulness meditation teacher, and she's been practicing this and teaching it for many years. Getting back to what we were talking about, tell us about who is involved in the United States with teaching mindfulness and how it got to be more publicly known.
Yeah, well, there are a number of people teaching mindfulness now, but the origins of mindfulness are really, specifically this word mindfulness, are in the traditions of the East, specifically in Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And the word mindfulness itself is actually an English translation of the Pali word sati, which in its original meaning means to remember or to recollect. And originally, I think that word was used in the sense of recalling and remembering the spiritual teachings as a way of informing our lives. But I really like that association of remembering and recollecting, because for me, it means that we have this opportunity to, like we had said before, to collect ourselves and to really remember, as opposed to dismember,
mm-hmm.
All of the parts of ourselves. So I think, all of us have a tendency to want to dismember mm-hmm. or get rid of those parts of ourselves that maybe we don't like very much, mm-hmm. that cause us pain. And again, this is an opportunity to bring all of our parts together, to really just let them be as they are, non-judgmentally. So I really like that aspect of it. What is now considered to be the modern mindfulness movement
mm-hmm.
Is attributed to Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is a professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center.
Mm-hmm.
In 1979, he started the stress reduction clinic there,
mm-hmm.
and went on with his colleague to develop mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a very specific 8-week program.
Mm-hmm.
The type of mindfulness that I teach and meditation that I teach is not that. It's a very structured, specific program that is only available, you know, through that channel. But he is really the one who brought this idea of mindfulness into mainstream culture and into the field of medicine. And, you know, the repercussions of that have been tremendous, of course. So he's considered to be, in many ways, like the godfather of mindfulness.
And so how much is this spread into hospitals, medical centers, and so on?
I think it has spread quite widely, and there are a number of hospitals nationally. I don't know what all of
and
them
churches,
are.
I might add, and so forth. I wanted to ask about that.
Yeah, specifically in the field of medicine, mm-hmm. More and more studies are being done on mm-hmm. the health benefits of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
Studies are being done about how it can improve the lives of children, for example, can improve their cognitive performance, their performance in school, their emotional resilience, their ability to deal with bullying situations. So as the field grows, mm-hmm. more and more studies are being done about the benefits of it for different populations and in different areas.
I know there's this term, mind-body medicine, and in a lot of the patients that a lot of doctors have, increased stress hormones lead to degenerative breakdowns, weakens the immune system. And so what role does this play in healthcare and in medicine, in the clinic in which we work, as well as in healthcare in general in our society?
I think it plays an absolutely crucial role and can be an incredible tool and assist for people who are struggling with health issues, mental health issues, and physical health issues. You know, one of the things that I've seen in my years of working at the clinic and that Dr. Godman has talked about is that there's just been an unbelievable increase in the number of people who are coming to receive help for anxiety and depression,
for example.
And meditation, mindfulness practices can be incredibly useful for those things in all the ways that we've been talking about. You know, it increases emotional resilience. It increases our ability to just allow things to be as they are. It increases the relaxation response. There are lots of ways it can lower blood pressure. You know, again, we're in that little paradoxical area because mindfulness itself, as we've been talking about, is not about outcome. So we're not going into it from this, I'm going
to
do this so I
get... To lower my blood pressure.
So I get that, right.
Right.
Right. That may be an outcome mm-hmm. of the practice.
And studies have shown that.
Yes.
Have been done at major medical centers, correct?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Many studies have shown that.
Right.
But we get into a little bit of a paradoxical part of the conversation when we start talking about it that way. But yes, I think it has a huge role to play. And Jon Kabat-Zinn's work mm-hmm. has demonstrated that without a doubt.
You're saying that the paradox is if you go into mindfulness with a goal in mind and you don't achieve that goal of lowering your blood pressure or whatever it is, or lowering the amount of what you need to take for your anxiety or depression, or whatever stomach issues or GI issues you have, then that sets up a failure complex, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's
you haven't gotten the real benefit out of the daily practice of mindfulness.
Right, you've actually kind of missed the point. However,
yeah.
I will say that I think if anyone actually practices meditation, if you actually do it mm-hmm. consistently over time, it will be obvious what the benefits are. Even if you don't lower your blood pressure, there will be other benefits that will mm-hmm. be completely tangible and knowable and experienceable.
Having a sense of wonder about life part of mindfulness? I think part of the reason I ask this is that some nights, like last night on the new moon, I'll walk out and sit on the patio or the porch and not try to see a specific planet or constellation, but just feel the wonder of looking at the stars and seeing the Milky Way, strands of the Milky Way and so forth, that feeling of wonder really helps me to be mindful and aware in the present.
Yeah, absolutely. And this idea of beginner's mind is something that's really important. And we talk about that in class at the very beginning, but also just as a basic attitude toward life, I think. You know, it's a phrase from Suzuki Roshi who said, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, and in the expert's, there are few. And so it's this idea of bringing this, like you said, this attitude of curiosity and wonder and awe and openness to the practice, rather than, you know, this idea that we have a preconceived notion of what it's going to be like. We've done it before and it didn't work. I'm going to achieve some high spiritual state. You know, we just let all of that go and just approach with this real open, curious, innocent mind, mm-hmm. really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, again, that's part of the mood that I try to cultivate in the classes. Like, you know, we've just become so cynical. We've become so cynical in our culture in general, I think. And so to really bring that attitude of innocence and wonder and curiosity is just so important, and in itself, so healing for us, I think, as humans.
Are there books you suggest that people find to read about mindfulness and so forth? Oh. Is it necessary to read these books? And a lot of people want to read and learn more about it. What do you suggest? Do you ever suggest books?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, I suggest any of Jon Kabat-Zinn's books. For example, Full Catastrophe Living.
I've heard of that
book. The classic. Coming to Our Senses is another one that's really wonderful. There are many, many books about mindfulness out there now, and I'm also a pretty big reader myself, so I understand the wanting to read more about it. But really, you know, what it comes down to is actually doing it. So I would also suggest that if someone is interested, that they find a class or a teacher that they can connect with. And it also really helps to sit and practice with other people. It makes it much easier. And that's one of the things that I hear in my classes a lot. Like, you know, people try to sit at home alone, which is an important part of the practice, you know, solitary, silent practice. But it's also really great to come together with other people to do it, because the combined intention of everyone in the room really lifts everyone up. You know, it's a bigger container, a bigger energetic container that we can really use to support ourselves. And it's wonderful. It's really wonderful to practice with other people.
How has practicing mindfulness helped people who experience chronic pain, who might be taking opiates and so forth like that?
Yeah. You know, I'm not a researcher or a scientist, so I don't pay too much attention to that, because again, for me, the practice is about something else. However,
I think that's where my goal-oriented being a doctor comes in.
I was gonna say, you're a doctor, so it makes perfect sense that you would ask this question.
Right.
But what I do know is that mindfulness and the mindfulness stress reduction program that Jon Kabat-Zinn founded was initially created for people to help with chronic pain. So the way that it does that, again, it's very counterintuitive what we're talking about. So this idea that we're allowing pain to be, to, as he would say, put out the welcome mat for it, goes exactly opposite to what we normally try to do.
Right.
Which is,
why would I want to welcome pain into
exactly.
my life?
Yeah.
But
however, when we do that, as we find when we practice mindfulness, when we allow whatever it is to just be there, all of a sudden we realize, all of a sudden there's some space around it. All of a sudden we realize that the person who is observing the pain is not affected by the pain. So there's pain and then there's us. And so it's there, but it doesn't have to overwhelm us and kind of take us under. So just that, and that's true for whether it's physical pain, emotional pain, any kind of difficult situation that we find ourselves in. When we do the practice, we experience this disidentification, if you will, mm-hmm. with whatever it is that's arising in the moment. So we tap into a deeper part of ourselves. We tap into that deep awareness that is part of who we are as human beings, that is not affected by anything that arises and subsides, which can be a very profound realization, which is, you know, the doorway into the deeper spiritual realizations that come from practice. But it's incredibly practical mm-hmm. and useful
yes.
to everyday
life. It
feels
that way, the way you're talking about it. You know, a lot of people today go through financial stress. Am I going to have enough? Am I, as a single mother, going to have enough to feed my children and pay the rent and all that kind of stuff? It feels like mindfulness practice on a daily basis. What I'm hearing in what you're saying is that creating that space so that the pain of not having enough, talk about that a little bit, how mindfulness would work. I don't want to verbalize it with my thoughts and
yeah.
stuff.
Well, what you're speaking about now reminds me a little bit of the work of Dr. Kristen Neff, who is a associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and mm-hmm. she's done a lot of, she's a researcher,
mm-hmm.
and she's done a lot of research into compassion, and specifically into self-compassion. And we talk about this a little bit in class, and I haven't studied her work extensively, but I'm very intrigued by the programs she's developed and what she's found about that. So again, this whole non-judgmental piece mm-hmm. about mindfulness is really, it's one of the keys to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that happens when we're suffering in any way
mm-hmm.
is we tend to kind of judge ourselves about that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we tend to be very, very hard on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about self-compassion, it's really this idea of treating ourselves as a loved one. So if we think about, if we look at it for a moment, if we think about how we are with ourselves when we're suffering in any way, it's very different than how we would be with other people. So if our friends are suffering, we reach out to them, we comfort them, we say it's going to be all right. When we're suffering, we tend to not do that. The attitude and the tone that we take with ourselves is very different. So that's a very intriguing area for me, and something that I talk about a lot in the class are ways that we can develop that self-compassion, which then connects us more deeply with others.
The class you are teaching is full right now.
It is, yeah. But I will be offering that introductory class.
Yeah, another introductory class.
Yeah, I'll be doing that ongoingly.
Good.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. I just wanted maybe to end with this quote from Jon Kabat-Zinn that has been very inspirational to me, and really for me summarizes the whole context of everything that we've been talking about. So he says, "It is indeed a radical act of love just to sit down and be quiet for a time by yourself. It is only love that can give us insight into what is real and what is important. And so a radical act of love makes sense. Love for life and for the emergence of one's truest self."
That was beautiful. Paula, thank you for joining us today and sharing. It's a lot of wisdom, and I must say, this was very touching for me, and there were tears sometimes coming to my eyes during this interview, stuff coming up for me. So it was a real process of being present in the moment with you during this interview. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Go out and make it a good day, everyone, and have a good day.
Healthy Medicine is produced by ComWest Communications in partnership with Prescott Public Radio and the Arizona Public Radio Network.